Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So, without further ado, let me say a couple of things about the way I envision this talk. Heresy will certainly figure in this lecture, but then to talk about Dostoevsky and theology and religion in any way naturally will lead you to that, because one might very well argue that Dostoevsky's own theology is somewhat heretical, certainly from a Catholic point of view. On the one hand, there is a very robust Christology. He's that is certainly firm and in many ways quite orthodox. But he also had some very peculiar features, and in my early remarks I will dwell on those, he, for instance, never particularly aligned himself with the Russian Orthodox Church. It's noticeable in all kinds of ways that he takes a rather somewhat eccentric position relative to the religious established Church in Russia. And he's, of course, fiercely anti-Catholic. That should not be forgotten. Although, as is pointed out to Ivan by Alyosha in that at the end of the chapter on the Grand Inquisitor, Ivan's conception of Catholicism seems to be somewhat cartoonish and derived from itself a rather cartoonish conception of specifically the Jesuit order. But let me start by saying a couple of things about Dostoevsky in relation to religion and theology more generally. And the first thing that stands out when you read Dostoevsky and then begin to sort of sift the impact he has had on modern literature and philosophy is you will find that he had a tremendous influence outside of literature as well as within. Writers who responded to him profoundly include Nietzsche, who read him in French translations as soon as they appeared. He couldn't fast enough to get his hands on them. Sigmund Freud wrote a short book, short essay on Dostoevsky and found him fascinating. Franz Kafka, Thomas Mann, André Gide, William Faulkner, Albert Camus, who actually set one of Dostoevsky's novels, Demons, turned it into a theater play. Jean-Paul Sartre, J.M. Coetzee, and so on. He influenced also, and this is certainly important in the context of 20th century theology, Catholic and Protestant, he influenced theologians of the early 20th century to a considerable degree. Among them, Sergius Bulgakov, Romano Guardini, the Catholic philosopher of the early 20th century, Michael Tournesen and Karl Barth, Hans Urs von Balthasar, and many others. And in our own time, the Anglican theologian, former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, wrote an excellent book on Dostoevsky. So you can see the resonance is uncharacteristically wide and deep. Now, perhaps that's even more surprising when we consider that Dostoevsky actually was not a particularly well-read person when it comes to theology. He begins embracing Orthodox Christianity while he is in his labor camp in Siberia, where, in fact, the Bible was the only permitted book. As you may know, Dostoevsky was arrested for political conspiracy in 1849, and following a mock execution, which, of course, he didn't know was a mock execution, which made a tremendous impact on him psychologically. He was sent to Siberia for 5 years of hard labor and then 5 years of exile. And so that was the book that was allowed, that he read it daily. And his readings in the Bible are certainly felt in the texture of the Brothers Karamazov, because there are allusions to scripture all over the place. That said, while Dostoevsky's theology is very biblicist in some ways, it's also its relationship to the church is rather peculiar. It is, for instance, rather remarkable that there is, as far as I know, not a single scene in any of Dostoevsky's fictions set in a church. And you will not hear typically any priests giving homilies or dispensing counsel. And those religious figures that do, notably, say, Bishop Tikhon in Demons or the elder Zosima in Brothers Karamazov, are themselves outside. Tikhon is retired, and Zosima is looked at with suspicion, by some even with loathing, in his own community. They are eccentric. They are not peripheral to the community of the Orthodox Church. So that, I think, already helps us sort of look at Dostoevsky as someone who, while profoundly influenced by the Christian message, is in many ways a very curious presence within that tradition. Now, he's also no theologian, makes no claim to being anything of the sort. His theological reading, in fact, is rather thin, as far as we know. There are, however, a few figures, the Slavophile philosophers of the mid-19th century, Alexei Komiakov, Ivan Kerievsky, and then the younger Vladimir Soloviev, who you might describe not as theologians so much as philosophical theologians, who had quite a bit of influence on him. What he did read, however, and we do know that, is he read quite extensively in a multi-volume edition of patristic writings, so writings of the Church Fathers, published under the title of the Philokalia, initially in Church Slavonic and then in Russian, beginning in 1797 and then in several reprints, and he had access to that, we know that much. And he continues to study scripture, and I'll give you an example of how he responds to it. In the letter from 1875 to his wife, Anna Grigorievna, he writes that, once again, and this happens regularly with him, the writing isn't quite working, it's not coming together, and he finds that precisely at this moment, he is sort of approaching a state of depression and also turns to scripture. I'm reading, he writes, about Elijah and Enoch. It is superb. I'm reading the book of Job, and it transports me into ecstasy. It is a strange thing, Anya. This book was one of the first things that impressed me in life. The book of Job certainly figures prominently in many of his novels, at least by way of allusion. Now, does Dostoevsky give us a theological novel? Or in what sense, if any, is Dostoevsky a religious writer, whatever that concept finally means? I think the answer probably will have to be something along these lines. Dostoevsky means, and certainly in the Brothers Karamazov does this most fully, he means to dramatize for us the spiritual cost of the moral wasteland that's created by embracing a strictly naturalistic and immanent view of existence, which is what he saw happen in 19th century Russia and, of course, even more so in Western Europe, where he had spent quite a bit of time. As a novelist, however, in modern Europe, then buffeted by liberal, secular, socialist, anarchist, and nihilistic movements, as a novelist, his work remains necessarily ambiguous with regard to whether faith can ultimately offer a lasting and sustainable resolution to his narratives. So readers of Brothers Karamazov have often wondered whether he didn't allow Ivan's critique of Christianity, of Christ's message in particular, in the Grand Inquisitor chapter and in the one called Rebellion that precedes it, whether Dostoevsky didn't perhaps allow Ivan's critique to be too powerful and to go substantially unrefuted. Now, it is fair to say that in those chapters, Ivan's critique is not refuted. It will, however, I would say, substantially be refuted in the book that follows, on the Elder Zosima, and in fact, in many regards, in the remainder of the novel, such that by the end of the novel, Ivan does things for which by his own philosophical reasoning, he could never account. Now, as for so many characters then, well, let me home in a little bit on book five, and the protagonists, of course, Alyosha principally, and Ivan in particular, who dominates that book. This book called Pro and Contra, dominated by Ivan's personality, which I think one can fairly describe as gifted, aloof, brooding, and proud. By then he has come into focus for us because earlier in the book it is, for instance, mentioned that he has written an essay on the ecclesiastical courts published in a journal. And what is fascinating is that that essay is a kind of characterized by what you might call a sinister ambiguity. I won't dwell on it now, but you will find that in the discussion, and I'm following the Michael Katz translation, which I can warmly recommend. It has the advantage over some of the other more recent translations of also being good English. It is in those early chapters in the book that the reference to that essay is made. And the question that Ivan is ultimately pushing is, can there be such a thing as ecclesiastic courts as opposed to what? Either the church has, the church is such that it dominates the seculum completely. If it compromises with secular powers, then in a way one might say it has already betrayed itself. So it's a kind of almost Erastian vision, which we will then see fleshed out in his Grand Inquisitor chapter. Now, Alyosha, who in some ways from the get-go is sort of characterized as the unremarkable hero of the novel, is a strikingly different figure from Ivan. Ivan, notably, and this is of course the fact that you find in virtually all of Dostoevsky's fictions are fictions about broken families. And Ivan is a particularly interesting figure in this regard. His father repeatedly forgets that Ivan is his son. And he will even remark to Alyosha at one point, probably in a state of advanced inebriation, that he's not one of us. By contrast, Alyosha is very much identified with his mother, and I'll come to that in a second. As for Ivan, he is typical for the son who has not really ever received parental love or even been introduced to anything you could call a functioning family. He seeks his home elsewhere. And where typically do characters of the 19th century, mid-19th century Russian fiction find a home? They find it in the world of ideas. The world of ideas in a way offers itself as a substitute for a home that they never had. Not least because it allows these characters to give rational expression to their unconfessed skepticism and anger. Alyosha then, by contrast, is associated very firmly with his mother, also in physical appearance. But he's also especially informed by his memories of his mother kneeling before the icon, and I quote here, a lamp burning in front of it, praying to the mother of God for him, holding him, the young infant or young toddler, holding him out to the icon with both hands as if asking the mother of God's protection. Perhaps this image and its sacred power has imprinted itself in Alyosha's mind, a little bit like an Urbild in Goethe's theory, or in fact, something like such that Alyosha might even be characterized as the image for which the icon is the prototype. He has a somewhat angelic disposition and tends to express often, not always entirely warranted, trust and love towards those whom he meets. He fits in some ways into the Russian tradition of the holy fool, a kind of uniquely Russian phenomenon, a phenomenon of Russian fiction. People who seem in their eccentric demeanor to be perceived as somehow spiritually gifted, but also not to be functioning according to normal social patterns. Rowan Williams says they are sort of defined by a conspicuous disregard for rational norms. And there is, in fact, something about them that sort of reveals what Williams calls the anarchic character of divine grace. And an intensified spiritual risk attaches to the authority of these odd characters, of which Alyosha is somewhat like the elder Zosima, who is his mentor, of whom he is one. Now, whether they are just truly divinely inspired or just plain mad cannot be rationally verified. In any event, the Holy Fool exemplifies a Russian orthodoxy's fascination with irrational states. A certain predisposition, as Ron Williams puts it, in Russia, to regard the simple or even the manifestly insane as attended by an aura of sacred immunity. We are here, in any event, at a far remove from the intellectual and rationalistic world of Ivan. And that's certainly the contrast we see between the hyper-rationalism, the Euclidean mind, as it is called, of Ivan, and these of far more intuitive kind of saintliness that seems to be taking shape ever so tentatively in Alyosha. We are also, which is to say that we are also, if Alyosha is our sort of beacon for a certain way of allowing Christian belief to shape one's life, we also are the very far removed, say, from the intellectualism of the Dominicans, or for that matter, the Jesuits. Now, the relative place of Book 5 in the novel, which is the book on which I want to focus today, there's been, I think, for a long time, a kind of tendency to focus and arguably over-focus on so-called peak moments in this novel. The chapters Rebellion and the Grand Inquisitor surely would be Exhibit A of such a claim, as well as Ivan's late spectral encounter with the devil late in the novel. I think it would be a mistake to read the novel as though there's a kind of criminal trial novel, there's a murder, and then there are theological issues, and they sort of exist, as it were, in compartmentalized ways. They do not. In fact, even the slightest human interaction is theologically charged in this book. And this is true when Alyosha meets Lise at the monastery early, or Alyosha and the downtrodden Captain Snegior, and countless other characters. Every encounter, in a way, is a fundamental test of the possibility of an ethical community. Often the test is failed, but it is clear in the wake of such an encounter, at least to one of the participants, that the test has then been failed, or sometimes that it has been met. Now, chapter 3 is where we first begin to get a glimpse of Ivan's nihilistic sort of personality. It already surfaces in his skeptical response to a remark by Alyosha, who at one point says, everyone should love life above everything else. Ivan responds, to love life more than its meaning? Alyosha is rejoined as unequivocal. Absolutely. To love it before logic, as you say, absolutely before logic, and only then will I understand its meaning. Now, for his part, Ivan conceives of life strictly as the sum total of meanings formulated by human beings and proven in syllogistic form. At the same time, Ivan is also smart enough to recognize that this kind of hyper-rationalist stance is in fact impossible to sustain. For which reason he says early on that he prefers to live only until age 30, and then, as he puts it, to dash the cup. Because he says at that point it'll become too hard to fool oneself. With that, the question of God has at least implicitly been raised. Now, even to call it a question, though, is to slant the conversation between Alyosha and Ivan in Book 5 towards apologetics. However, I would maintain that the Brothers Karamazov is fundamentally not an exercise in apologetics. For one thing, Dostoevsky's approach to the novel is dialogic and dramatic, not didactic. Furthermore, the novel is not interested in hypotheses, but rather in giving us what Dostoevsky once calls in the letter a higher realism, that is, to capture the dramatic structure of our existence. Rather than ask whether God exists, and it is noteworthy that neither Ivan nor Alyosha postulate anything to the contrary. Rather than ask whether God exists, the numerous encounters throughout the book instead have us broach a different question. First, how humankind has fared by denying God, and secondly, how accepting God will both require and enable us to conform our lives to Christ's precepts and teachings. Ivan's question, how human beings, so deprived, so depraved and cruel, how they could have conceived of the idea of the necessity of God, as he puts it, is not concerned finally with proofs of God, but rather with coming to a judgment about the world that he created. And this is where the Gnostic sort of implications of Ivan's position begin to shine through. And here I'll quote a little bit from the novel. I'll do this on a few occasions, which I think will also help us remind us a little bit of the sort of voice that Dostoevsky gave. For those who happen to have access to the Michael Katz translation, it is on page 279. As Ivan says, it's not God that I don't accept, you must understand, but the world created by him. I don't accept God's world and can't agree to accept it. I make the following proviso. I'm convinced, like a child, that suffering will be healed and alleviated, that all the offensive comicality of human contradictions will disappear like a pitiful mirage, like the vile ruminations of an infinitesimally small, feeble Euclidean mind, which, in the last analysis, at world's end, at the moment of eternal harmony, something so valuable will transpire that it will be sufficient for all hearts, for the comforting of all indignation, for the expiation of people's wicked deeds, all the blood shed by them. It'll be possible not only to forgive, but even to justify everything that has happened to people. May all this come to pass, but I don't accept it, and I don't wish to accept it. Even if parallel lines meet and I myself get to see it, I see it and say they've met, still I won't accept it. The world for Ivan is essentially, let me put this slightly differently. For Ivan, the world is essentially the product of what we might call an ontological miscarriage. Better, he argues, would have been for God not to have created anything. In other words, for God to have allowed the nothing, the nihil, to persist, which is why Ivan longs above all for the restitution of nothingness. Here, you know, we see very clearly Ivan echoing in so many words the Gnostic distinction between the creator God, the Demiurgos, and the Redeemer God. Yet the question naturally arises, even as Alyosha seems painfully shy and reluctant to raise it, the question certainly at this point already arises, certainly for the reader of the novel, is it ever for us to so judge God's creation? Does judgment of this kind not presume a quasi-divine perspective, as though we ourselves were not part of creation? And it is very noticeable how Ivan, as he talks about it, always speaks as though he was somehow looking at the world as something of which he's not part. He doesn't seem to be able to imagine that he himself is already in it. We note that he speaks as someone detached from everything and everyone, a person without any project, without any hope in life, with no summum bonum. And finally, one might also ask, is there no alternative to Ivan's Euclidean rationalism? One is reminded here, I think, of Chesterton's wonderful definition in Heresies of a madman. A madman is not someone who's lost his reason. A madman is someone who has lost everything except his reason. That's, I think, in many ways a good definition of the character we get here of Ivan at this point in the book. Now, it bears recalling, in this regard, by the way, that Aquinas' five ways in the Summa Theologiae, question three, that Aquinas in those five ways is also not concerned with the ontological question of whether God exists, and sit in the Latin, but rather with how our imperfect intellects may access and most fully participate in God's numinous reality. To put it in our terms, God's existence does not depend on the ingenuity of our proofs or demonstrations. For if God exists, then he will ere ipsa do so as an all-encompassing reality and not as a mere notion or concept of our own devising. Conversely, that also means that our relationship to God is never just notional, but instead is a matter of what John Henry Newman would call our real assent, or as Anselm of Canterbury had famously put it, it is a case of fides querens intellectum, faith seeking understanding, which is to say active love seeking knowledge of God. Now, let me talk a little bit more about this fourth chapter, rebellion. In contrast, Ivan's Gnostic outlook logically rejects all utopias, religious and secular. For even, he argues, if a perfect community of human beings could ever be realized on Earth, nothing in his view could ever justify the suffering that had preceded it. He maintains, therefore, that the world created by God is an absurdity, as he puts it, a chimera, a hideous farce, impossible to justify. What's more, he contends, not without reason, that we are all implicated in this hideous farce. There is, he says to his brother Alyosha, there is a little devil sitting in your heart too. Now, Dostoevsky might have been surprised to learn that this position, Ivan's position, is in some ways quite close to Augustinian teaching. Original sin is inherited, and as such, has left all of humankind damaged and disordered, both in will and in intellect. A committed Christian, so Ivan argues, would therefore have to accept the myriad forms of cruelty and suffering such as transpire every day in this world, and they would have to accept them as, he puts it, simply as a fertilizer for some future harmony. That includes, notably, the suffering of animals and of little children, for which Ivan maintains no explanation or justification is even remotely possible. I note, by the way, in passing, that in Dostoevsky's fiction, scenes of cruelty to children and animals is one of the most recurrent motifs. Also in his diary of a writer and in his letters, this comes up almost with obsessive frequency. Now, so as for children, animals, and the all kinds of vulnerable creatures, Ivan asked, why have they also ended up as the compost needed to fertilize someone else's future harmony? It's a weighty question. Now, to assess the cogency of Ivan's account, I think it's important for us not to just evaluate his claims and his premises. We must also ask which concepts of a Christian grammar might be missing, and there are some that are missing. Crucially, his account does not include or in any way draw on concepts such as love, forgiveness, which in turn would presuppose the infused theological virtue of hope. As he admits, in the absence of hope, love, and faith, all he can do is, quote, operate by my own lights. And he realizes, to his credit, that that too is ultimately impossible. So he, Dostoevsky here, by the way, sees through Ivan, we see this once again, this association of nihilism as a kind of a self-defeating construct of ideas. It's very closely associated in Dostoevsky's fiction with the event, or with the idea of suicide. And there are many characters, of course, in Dostoevsky's fiction that commit suicide or are at least very much fascinated by it. I think of Svidrigailov in Crime and Punishment, or Gorzin and Hippolyte in The Idiot, Kirillov in Stavrogin in Demons, and then Smerdyakov, of course, the Brothers Karamazov, and so on. But be that as it may, Ivan nevertheless continues to overestimate the powers of intellect, even as he recognizes that intellect and reason can only offer a diagnosis, but never a solution to the pervasive misery of human existence. What he signally fails to grasp, or at times overtly rejects, are the practical virtues, both moral and theological: mercy, forgiveness, humility, hope, faith. Blinding Ivan to their importance is his apparent lack of the greatest of all virtues, love. In the absence of love, Ivan's intellect is destined to lose its bearing, and this is what the narrative certainly shows. While he's right to reject vengeance as, quote-unquote, useless, he is evidently mistaken to reject the right to forgive, as he calls it. And here I'll briefly give you a quote from the end of the chapter, Rebellion. Is there a creature in the whole world who is able, who has the right to forgive? I don't want any such harmony. Out of love for mankind, I don't want it. I prefer to remain with the sufferings unexpressed. It's better if I remain with my unavenged suffering and my unappeasable indignation, even if I'm wrong. Too high a value has been placed on harmony. It's beyond our means to pay so much for an entrance ticket. And so I hasten to return my ticket. If I'm an honest man, I'm obliged to return it as soon as possible, which is in many ways an allusion, again, to suicide. Ivan's preoccupation with suffering, and we remember in this context again Dostoevsky's lifelong absorption in the Book of Job in particular, his preoccupation with suffering defines the impasse to which, according to Zosima's teachings, Christ offers the only conceivable answer, albeit with this proviso, that the answer here takes not the form of an abstract proposition, but rather is realized as active love in concrete interpersonal settings. Let's turn now a little bit to the chapter on the Grand Inquisitor. By the way, we know that this goes back at least to the mid-1870s. There is an interesting letter by Dostoevsky from June 7th, 1876, in which he pretty much outlines the argument that will appear in, that Ivan will then make, in a, give us, in the form of what he calls a poema, a poem, a fictional parable. One of the more interesting features which I explored with students in a graduate seminar on Dostoevsky theology last semester is that many of the opening biblical quotations that Ivan allows to slip into his prose are not quite accurate. It's as though Dostoevsky was trying to alert us to the fact that maybe Ivan's recollection of scripture is a little bit shoddy. I won't dwell on this now, but it's been one of the more interesting features of the opening of that chapter. Now, Ivan admits freely to Alyosha that he has crafted this parable in such a way as to illustrate a particular dilemma or impasse, and therefore also to lead to a particular conclusion. So this is a kind of didactic statement in a certain way, a parable very much in the didactic sense. But even so, at first its drift seems to elude Alyosha, who, oddly enough, also doesn't quite realize that in the early phase of the parable, Ivan is retelling the story of Christ raising Lazarus, which, by the way, plays a hugely pivotal role, really, in at the sort of peak moment in Crime and Punishment, when Raskolnikov asks Sonia to read that Powerpuff Scriptures to him. Being a projection of Ivan's position, the Grand Inquisitor regards the three temptations of Christ in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 4 as encapsulating the entire future history of mankind. It's a rather grandiose claim. Now, he takes this episode in the Gospels to furnish, and I quote, a synthesis of all the unresolved contradictions of human nature on earth. And here again, a quick, brief passage. The terrible and clever spirit, the spirit of self-annihilation and non-existence, so the old man, the Inquisitor, continues addressing Christ in Ivan's parable. This terrible and clever spirit, the spirit of self-annihilation, is the great spirit that spoke to you in the wilderness. And in books we are told that he supposedly tempted you. Isn't that so? And could one possibly state anything truer than what he asked you in those three questions, which you rejected? Questions that are referred to in Scripture as temptations. The fact is, if there was ever really an astounding miracle on earth, it took place that day, the day of the three temptations. It was precisely in the posing of those three questions that the genuine miracle occurred. So Ivan's parable very specifically dwells on this passage. What is the core issue? The core issue has to do surely with the question of human freedom. Christ's terrifying alternative, and it is characterized by the Grand Inquisitor as terrifying, his terrifying alternative revolves around the paradox of freedom. Just as conversely the Grand Inquisitor's vision, like Ivan's, is in essence nihilistic and denies the very possibility of freedom, or if there is freedom, argues that it is utterly undesirable. Now, Nicholas Berdyaev, one of Dostoevsky's early and rather perceptive readers, in a book called Dostoevsky and Interpretation, I believe from 1930 or so, 31, formulates the dilemma, the fundamental dilemma very well, and I quote from Berdyaev. Free goodness involves the freedom of evil, that's to say freedom, to being free to commit evil. But evil leads to the destruction of freedom itself and its degeneration into an evil necessity. On the other hand, the denial of the freedom of evil in favor of an exclusive freedom of good ends equally in the negation of freedom and its degeneration, that is, into a good necessity. But a good necessity is not good because goodness resides in freedom from necessity. Ivan puts it almost exactly like that in this chapter. Now, it is first in this extensive working through in the Grand Inquisitor chapter of the three temptations of Christ in Matthew chapter 4, that Ivan seems to become associated with the devil. Not so much, however, I would argue, as not so much in the sense of identifying the two, but rather as shown, presenting to us the devil as the spectral other of Ivan. The devil's temptation aligns in many ways with 19th century materialist political utopias, socialism in particular, whose totalitarian future Dostoevsky had remarkably extrapolated in his previous novel, Demons. We might add to those temptations perhaps the Western alternative of a kind of rampant consumerism, living by bread alone, taking that in its figurative sense. Here I'll quote again from the novel. This is now a slightly longer quote from page 301 for those who want to go back to it. No science will ever give them bread while they remain free, but all this will end when they bring their freedom and lay it at our feet and say, it's better that you enslave us, but feed us. They themselves will come to understand at last that freedom and enough earthly bread for everyone are inconceivable together, for never will they be able to share it among themselves. They will also become convinced that they can never be free, because they are weak, depraved, worthless, and rebellious. You promised them the bread of heaven. But I repeat once again, can that compare with earthly bread in the eyes of the weak, irrevocably vicious, and endlessly ungrateful human race? The Grand Inquisitor outlines his alternative, a kind of frictionless, you might almost say post-human community, where existence will be essentially somatic. It will be unencumbered by material want, and where life will unfold free of the experience of freedom, despair, hope, or love. Having been left in a state of freedom, man, as the Grand Inquisitor says, had no greater desire than to place it at the feet of someone who would relieve them of this terrifying gift. By implication, the Grand Inquisitor's vision rests on a strictly Erastian model of religion, that is, Christianity and its institutions operating at the behest and in the interest of the modern state. Such a framework is by definition coercive, and in Dostoevsky's work tends to be associated, one has to say rather superficially and inaccurately, with both socialism and Catholicism. He runs those two together in very peculiar ways. Just one more indication of his own somewhat heretical turn of mind. As already noted, the Inquisitor's project clearly foreshadows 20th century totalitarianism, since its overriding aim is to remake man into a compliant animal. Think of George Orwell's 1984. And in so doing, to neutralize forever the effects of original sin. The second temptation in particular highlights this as another aspect, namely humanity's deep-seated need for the miraculous. Ivan here draws on anthropological speculations by Feuerbach, Strauss, Giscard, and Ernst Renan in the 19th century, writers whom Dostoevsky certainly knew, having spent quite a bit of time with them during the 1860s in particular. They embody for Dostoevsky the pernicious effect of Western European culture, especially on what he calls the Russian soul. Even so, the Inquisitor's critique here does cut very deep. He says, 15 centuries have passed. Come, he says to Christ, come and look at them. Is there anyone at all you have raised up to your level? Nevertheless, even if man is weak and worthy of contempt, as Ivan and the Inquisitor, not inaccurately, well, certainly is weak, not inaccurately suggest, I think the late Augustine would have found himself nodding in agreement, still, his longing for self-transcendence, the longing of every human being to transcend their present condition, seems ineradicable and irrepressible. Crucially, the Inquisitor's contention centers on the precept of love. And what he argues is that Christ's great mistake was to love human beings more than he loved himself. Now, let's step back for a moment and ask, how is this parable being received? There's, of course, only at this moment in the tavern, there's only one listener, it's Alyosha, and he receives this poema, as Ivan keeps calling it, almost without comment, just as, notably, Christ listens to the Inquisitor's harsh declaration in complete silence. And yet, in Alyosha's case, silence also attests to the fact that he is still himself, still struggling to conceive how his faith will bear and will be realized in the future. He's still not quite sure how to distinguish between a faith actively lived and faith simply as a sum total of past events in the history of Christianity recounted in Scripture and in the teachings of Jesus, or for that matter, the elder Zosima, to whom Alyosha early in the book seems to have an almost idolatrous sort of attachment. Alyosha, this is simply to say that Alyosha has not yet quite put his own faith to the test in the world outside the monastery. And that is precisely, and with very good reason, what his elder Zosima instructs he must do. Yet if Christianity truly has a future, it must be as a gospel of freedom realized as active love in concrete relation to other human beings, and not as a system of enforced obedience or institutionally administered relief. In other words, revelation must continuously accomplish itself in life, rather than being reduced to a mere inventory of historical facts or a notional creed. Part of Alyosha's predicament, as he is being tempted, you might say, by Ivan's nihilistic faith, and indeed repeatedly throughout the novel, part of his predicament has to do with the fact that his spiritual formation is still very much in progress. His intuitions and his virtues are still in the process of consolidation. Let me summarize then a little bit what I think we can take away from this particularly momentous part of the novel. The parable of the Grand Inquisitor, and this is theologically one of the more intriguing points, it seems to me. The parable of the Grand Inquisitor curiously inverts the reigning, you might say the dominant, secular narrative that the 19th century likes to tell itself about Christianity. That narrative maintains that one should conceive of Christ as the historical Jesus, an exemplary man, to be sure, not the Son of God. There is no God on this account. And someone whose teachings, alas, had subsequently been appropriated and badly distorted by the Church. This is the kind of argument you can see taking shape in Immanuel Kant's Religion Within the Boundaries of Reason Alone from 1793, and then it will become more sort of aggressively formulated by Strauss, Renan, Durkheim, and in a very different key, also interestingly, by Kierkegaard. By contrast, the Grand Inquisitor takes exactly the obverse view. He says the Church has corrected Christ's example, not distorted it. He says, we have corrected your example, and I quote, and based it on miracle, mystery, and authority. Like Kierkegaard's, Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor presents Christ's love and the Church's care in strictly antinomian fashion. Although, of course, with this difference, that it is, in the Grand Inquisitor's mind, the Church, and not Christ, that will provide salvation. In large measure, Dostoevsky's model for an ecclesia that is not with you, Christ, but with mankind, this model had been furnished for, or had at least sort of crystallized in Dostoevsky's imaginary when he found himself studying the dealings of the Jesuit order in the modern period. And he crudely, and it has to be said again quite distortedly, takes the Jesuits as the very essence and synonym of modern Catholicism and socialism. And yet, there is a kernel of truth to the Inquisitor's assurance that in his care, people, and I quote, will love us like children because we allow them to sin. And every sin can be expiated if it is committed with our permission. Now, such language, it happens, recalls rather vividly the laxism or casuistry for which the Jesuits had developed a reputation in the 17th century. Now, you might read, and we don't have to take Dostoevsky's word for it, I wouldn't, because he just hadn't studied the materials well enough. But you could, for instance, read Blaise Pascal's 1656 Provincial Letters, in which he, which are, by the way, one of the most uproariously funny exploration of a theological, key theological issue, the question of grace, in which a kind of jejune and a rather unsophisticated novice goes to try and get explanations about how the concept of grace could be understood in relation to the notion of Christian freedom. And the answers he gets from the Jesuits, well, they do seem rather particular. Now, Alyosha appropriately at the end of this chapter, he detects in Ivan's and the Inquisitor's program what he calls only the worst part of Catholicism, the Jesuits. And so Alyosha already pushes back and says, this is surely not it. However, I would say it's sort of interesting always to ask, you know, in what sense does this have a bearing on our moment? I might, for instance, suggest that in many ways this narrative that the Grand Inquisitor tends, or the model of the Church, as it were, solving for us the impossible demands of Christ's teaching, and receiving and for once and forever putting away this terrifying gift of freedom, that this kind of narrative that the Grand Inquisitor develops has had a significant afterlife, periodically anyway. For instance, we might think of American Catholicism's ongoing love affair with integralism. There is, in other words, a kind of enduring appeal to the Grand Inquisitor's project of what we might, you know, call the Ecclesia Militans Atque Triumphans, you know, the Church, as he says, and here I quote, this is the Grand Inquisitor wrapping things up. He says, there will be a long wait before its completion, the completion of his project of earth, controlled by an all-encompassing order of the Church. There will be a long wait before its completion, and the earth will suffer a great deal, but we will ultimately triumph and will become Caesars. And then we will devise a plan to ensure the happiness of all humanity. You yourself, he says to Christ, could have taken up Caesar's sword back then. Why did you reject that last gift? Had you accepted the final bit of advice from the powerful spirit, you would have accomplished everything that man seeks on earth. That is, have someone to worship, have someone to whom he could surrender his conscience, making it possible for everyone to be united at last into one general, unanimous, and harmonious anthill. So, such language reflects a utopian conception of the Church, trading the visio beatifica of the scholastics for worldly power, which then henceforth will seek for everyone to be united at last, as it says, into a unanimous and harmonious anthill. I think it is interesting if you read, for instance, or if you find yourself rereading George Orwell's 1984, and you look at the very programmatic statement toward the end of the book, or by Goldstein, about the way that the party works. It's at times almost verbatim, in the way that it echoes almost verbatim passages from the Grand Inquisitor chapter. It's also eye-opening because what the Grand Inquisitor here does, Dostoevsky had previously worked out as the program of anarchism in demons, in particular through the figures of Shigalyov and Pyotr Verhovensky. The Grand Inquisitor's 20th century heirs, of course, are no longer religious figures, or at best pseudo-religious figures. We know them well by names of Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin, Lavrenti Beria, Pol Pot, Ceausescu, Mao, and so forth. And the roll call of personalities, both imperious and notorious, it is safe to assume will extend into the future. So finally, let us ask once more, what exactly is it that makes Christ's gift of freedom so terrifying? By the end of the chapter, that happens to be Alyosha's question too, and he asks, who will believe, he asks Ivan, who will believe what you say about Christ's conception of freedom? Is that really the way it's to be understood? In passing, we note here a distinctly Protestant drift to the Grand Inquisitor's account of freedom, tinged as it is with an existential pessimism that recalls Luther's Reformed Augustinian position, say on the freedom of the Christian, or also the bleak hyper-Augustinian theology of Port Royal in the mid-17th century. On this view, freedom is the deplorable condition into which humankind fell after the fall, or with the fall, rather than being an unconditional good enjoyed and to be retrieved in the fullness of time. And that, of course, is what Alyosha and Zosima will demonstrate for us in the remainder of the novel. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.